Welcome to the 70th A.W. Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts. In this six-part lecture series titled Contact, Art and the Pull of Print, art historian Jennifer L. Roberts will focus on printmaking as an art of physical contact, involving transfer under pressure between surfaces, a direct touch that can evoke multiple forms of intimacy. And yet it is simultaneously an art of estrangement. It requires the deferral, displacement, and distribution of artistic agency, and it trades in reversal and inversion. In this fourth lecture, Strain, premiered on the National Gallery's website on May 16, 2021, Roberts explores how many modern printmaking processes involve passing ink or light through screens or meshes, especially when converting continuous tone photographs into printable formats. These processes create the conditions in which most exchanges between the ink world of print and the light world of photography take place, and also link the practice of making images to a long history of straining, sifting, refining, and filtering in material and political realms beyond the art world.
Welcome, everyone, and welcome back. This is the fourth of six lectures focusing on what we might call the physics of print. And through that physics, the poetics and the politics of print in modern and contemporary art. Today's topic is strain. Now, as with all of the titles that structure this lecture series, I'm asking this keyword strain to do a lot of work. I'm asking it to function simultaneously in the literal register and the metaphorical register. But while my previous keywords like reversal and pressure had the virtue of being pretty self-evidently related to printmaking, strain may come as a bit of a surprise. It's not exactly a common printmaking term, and in fact, it's not really an art term at all. So let me elaborate a bit on the forms of printing I'll be discussing today and why I've chosen this word to guide us through them. Today, I'll be engaging with printing processes that are based on or inspired by the principle of the stencil matrix. This is a form of printmaking in which the image is essentially pushed through the matrix rather than pulled off of its face. Stencils are one of the four major types of printing matrix. A little review of matrices here. I've alluded to some of these terms in earlier lectures, but here's a summary of the different ways that the matrix can be coded into printing and non-printing areas. So first, there's relief, in which the printing areas stand up and ink is pulled only from the high point. Typical relief processes are woodcut and letterpress. Then there's intaglio, engraving, etching, aquatint, etc., in which the printing area is carved into the plate and ink is pulled out of those low areas. The planographic system is one in which the printing and non-printing areas are not separated topographically, but rather chemically. Lithography is the major example here. And then finally, stencil methods, in which the binary coding of the matrix is generated by closed and open areas that do or do not allow ink to pass through. This includes screen printing, but also just simple stenciling, as in the stencils used by Jasper Johns to make his number and letter paintings. Now, most of this lecture will focus on screen printing. As you recall from previous weeks, the screen printing matrix is a stencil suspended in or on a transparent mesh. Ink is blocked by the stencil and forced through the open areas of meshwork onto the support below. The image comes into being by being pushed through a screen. Now, for the purposes of this lecture, we'll be conceiving of this action as straining rather than screening. And there are three reasons for this. First, I want to emphasize the messy, material, mechanical realities of screen printing. To do this, it's helpful to nudge ourselves away a bit from the associations that the word screen has with film, television, and computing. I want to get us thinking about the notion that making a screen print is more like pouring soup into a strainer than it is like firing electrons at a cathode ray tube or projecting light onto a movie screen. Second, in using the word strain, I want to suggest something like the fatigue of the process. I want to emphasize the physical and conceptual consequences of the material agency of the screen matrix. Screen printing brings images into being in a field of forces, forces that actively shape them rather than neutrally transmitting them. Screen printing leaves its mark and puts images under strain. And finally, I want to use the connotations of straining in order to connect these images to a longer history of sifting, selecting, and filtering in material and political realms beyond the art world. I've already spoken in some detail about screen printing in my lecture on reversal. After today's lecture and next week's one, I'll have even more to say about it. I will have devoted an inordinate amount of my time, and by extension your time, to a printing process that has not previously been seen to be worthy of so much theoretical or philosophical or even descriptive attention on the part of art historians. Despite its obvious centrality for modern and contemporary art through the work of Warhol and Rauschenberg and others, the screen printing process itself, its history, its specific operations, its conceptual implications, has remained surprisingly understudied. This is partially because of the general inattention to print processes in contemporary art history. And it's partially because screen printing and other so-called process printing methods are the ones whose reputations remain most tightly bound to commercial and industrial image making. Even within the relatively specialized world of print studies, screen printing is a low-status medium compared to more effusively artisanal processes like etching, for example. One of the general subtexts of my lecture today is that if we're going to understand the life of print in contemporary art and take it seriously, we have to do a much better job of incorporating commercial processes into our models of the field. We need to loosen up about the hierarchical distinctions that we are prone to making between commercial and artisanal printmaking, and we need to bring all forms of printmaking into closer contact with the critical and theoretical models of art history. Which image-making processes get in to serious art history? Which are kept out? These questions swirl around screen printing in many ways at many levels, especially because screen printing itself, this process of straining images into being by letting some things through and holding some things back, links up directly with other cultural processes of purification, hygiene, and refinement. Screen printing is the last of the major analog print processes to have been developed. Although there is some uncertainty about a single origination point for it, it likely took on its current form in the very early 20th century in California. Like almost all Western print processes, it has much older precedents in East Asia, where there's a long tradition of stencil making for dyeing textiles. This is a Japanese katagami stencil used for resist dyeing openwork patterns on bolts of cotton or silk. The stencil is made of layers of handmade paper bonded together with persimmon tannin. It's reinforced with a hand-threaded mesh made with single strands of human hair or silk. Now, this anticipates screen printing in many ways. It's a complex stencil held together by a delicate mesh. But as an astonishingly fine tradition of hand craftsmanship, it developed in a different production context than screen printing as we know it. In 20th century screen printing proper, the screen mesh is much more closely spaced, and the mesh support, the screen, is ready-made, ready to receive the stencil. Now, screen printing per se was born as a commercial printmaking method. It was widely and rapidly adopted in advertising and display media, where it was prized for its ability to produce bold, flat, opaque color on virtually any surface. One of its earliest uses was for printing team names and logos on felt pennants. Screen printing could easily be used not only on paper, but also cardboard, wood, metal, textiles, cork, leather, fur, ceramics, and glass. It was a form of ambient printing, we might say, one that could go anywhere, could infiltrate the surfaces of the world. And this, of course, is why it was so attractive to advertising. Textile printing was one of its most important uses. It was faster and cheaper than many other fabric printing methods, with better color. This is why most t-shirts are now screen printed. Now, when Warhol began his screen print paintings in 1962, screen printing was perceived as an essentially commercial process and was excluded from the realm of fine printmaking as well as from the fine arts more generally. Attempts had been made in the inter- and post-war years to establish fine art credentials for it by masking or disavowing its commercial status. The print curator Carl Ziegrosser invented the term serigraphy, or silk writing, for precisely this purpose. But the process had not been able to shake its original associations with advertising and packaging, posters, calendars, signs, labels, boxes, etc. So that when the artists we associate with screen printing in the 60s took up this technology, it's difficult to exaggerate just how debased it was as a form of image making. Warhol took it up, of course, for precisely this reason. To make his paintings, he screened images, usually photographic halftones, onto unstretched canvases that had usually been prepared with a single color of paint. This one, for example, has an image screened in black on a ground of silver paint. Often these involved progressing across the canvas with the screen frame, repeating the image again and again, usually with intentionally irregular spacing and obvious degradations and glitches in the screen printing. And I'll have more to say about these glitches later on in this lecture. Now, I've been talking about Warhol transferring images to canvas by pushing them through the screen print stencil matrix. So Jackie gets onto the blue canvas here by virtue of ink being pushed through a screen. But where did the screen come from? How did Jackie's image get onto the screen mesh in the first place? I want to make a quick excursus here into the halftone to clarify its role in Warhol's process and also simply to introduce it to you because it will come back up next week. Also, I have found that the halftone process is not widely understood. It is not well known, so it's always worth a review. The photographs that Warhol incorporated into his work were rasterized as halftones, images broken down into those coarse dot patterns that formed and continue to form the backbone of all photographic printing in the 20th and 21st centuries. It's the halftone that makes it possible to print photographs because it turns continuous tone images into the binary patterns that the press can recognize. In this detail from Warhol's 1967 Maryland portfolio, you can get a better sense of the dot-like patterns that make up the image. What I want to emphasize for now is that this halftone pattern is itself made by passing an image through a screen. To make a halftone, you photograph a photograph through sheets of ruled glass that form a diagonal net pattern. Warhol's halftones were made through such screens, commercially using process cameras. Now, I found two incredible mid-century videos that give us a good sense of how the process camera and cross-line screens worked in commercial printing operations. These show halftones being made into metal plates for engraving, whereas in Warhol's case, they were made into screens for screen printing. But the translation principle is the same, and so I think these will be instructive for us. The first one here goes into some detail about the cross-line screen.
The first step of photo engraving, as the name implies, is photography. The illustration is placed on a copy board which faces the lens of an enormous camera. Since this is a continuous tone copy, it must be photographed through a half-tone screen, which is inserted in the back of the camera between the film and... Now let's take a closer look at the halftone screen, the very heart of photo engraving. A halftone screen consists of parallel etched lines on two glass plates. The plates are cemented so that the lines cross at right angles, thus producing transparent square apertures between the intersecting lines, and they are bound together by a metal frame. The screens vary from 50 to 200 lines per square inch. Coarser screens are used for newspaper printing, the fine screens for printing on enamel paper.
And then the second one gives you a better idea of the process camera.
But before a picture or drawing can be printed, it has to be etched on a metal plate. That's done in the engraving department by first photographing the picture through a screen. The screen breaks the picture into thousands of tiny dots. Each of these dot pictures is chemically transferred to a zinc plate. Then an acid eats away the zinc between the dots, leaving the dots to print the pictures. Looks simple, doesn't it? But fine quality engraving calls for real craftsmanship, and these Minnesota boys can deliver it.
Now, that last part about Minnesota boys was maybe not entirely necessary, but I couldn't resist leaving it in, not least because of the glimpse it gives us into the gender politics of the news print room. So here's a diagram of the apparatus of the process camera that you've just seen on these videos. In some ways, the most important part of this whole setup is that narrow space between the screen and the film emulsion, the so-called screen-to-plate distance. As light enters in through each of the tiny apertures on the screen, that aperture, that little space, works like its own lens, refocusing the light into a point. And the screen has to be at a precise distance from the plate, and the apertures of the screen have to be the right size for dot formation to occur. And one could go on about the complex physics of halftone formation, which is actually still an area of active inquiry and research among physicists. But for our purposes today, I simply want to note the way that Warhol's images emerge from a process of double screening or double straining. Light is first strained through the halftone screen in order to make the dot screen stencils, and then ink is strained through those stencils in order to produce the halftone on canvas. Warhol is directing an entire system of image formation based on forcing the movement of light and matter through tiny regular apertures, and the entire process is being borrowed from the commercial printing world. Now, given their direct origins in multiple forms of printing, it is, I think, a little ironic that Warhol's screen prints have been so thoroughly absorbed into the history of painting, so thoroughly co-opted, we might say, as painting. Warhol's prints on canvas are characterized, collected, displayed as paintings, with the implication being that by being done on canvas, they somehow transcend regular workaday screen printing. They engage in a radical off-label adaptation or creative misuse of the process. But actually, his paintings can accurately be described as screen prints, plain and simple. As we've seen, the definition and practice of commercial screen printing already included printing on canvas, including printing repeated screens on long rolls of uncut textiles, as in Warhol's Silver Elvises here. On the right is some recent video showing the printing of fabric for designer Yohji Yamamoto's 2011 fashion line. And I think you can see some of the similarities between this process and Warhol's Elvises. Warhol's fellow artists who knew about printing were fully aware that these could just as easily be classified as prints as paintings. Ed Ruscha said of Warhol's works, quote, "They archive them as paintings, although they were strictly silk screens. Yeah, they were prints on canvas, and that made all the difference in the world and even amused him. He liked that, the very fact that if you put it on a piece of paper and then take the same image and put it on a canvas, the canvas was worth more." Why do these need to be paintings to be taken seriously, to be valued? Why not look at Warhol's work as a form of printing that has its own structures of knowledge, its own skills, its own traditions? One of the reasons for this is that when commercial processes like screen printing have broken through into the larger narratives of contemporary art, they have tended to be equated with what's known as de-skilling. In the 1960s and 1970s, many artists renounced the skills associated with high art and its academic and economic structures and turned instead to repetitive, everyday, task-based methods. This happened everywhere from minimalism to conceptual art to dance and performance. Warhol's adoption of screen printing is a classic example of de-skilling in this sense. In fact, it was one that went on to inspire much of the language around de-skilling in the 70s and beyond. As the story goes, Warhol replaced centuries of traditional painting knowledge and all of the elaborate, expressive gesticulations of the Bohemian painter with a simple squirch of the squeegee. This is the value of Warhol's work in the history of painting, that it rejected the history of painting and all of its pieties. This is his radical postmodern gesture, and it's valued as such in art history. All this is true enough. But this approach, this de-skilling approach, has pushed screen printing, along with an entire range of other printing processes, into what I see as an interpretive corner. If screen printing is appreciated only as an evacuation of qualities, a removal of expertise, it can't logically be investigated as a positive process. If it's valued only as a form of de-skilling, it becomes invisible as a repository of skills, and there's no reason to look further into its history. So at precisely the moment that printing is acknowledged in art history, brought into the field here, it's dismissed as a process that's not worth investigating in any further detail. I want to argue today that perhaps some artists took up screen printing not only because it wiped away certain painterly skills and traditions, but also because it added a new set of skills, associations, and traditions in their place. If the squeegee wiped away painting, it also dragged other histories, materials, and skills into the art world, skills, it turned out, that derived from printing and other forms of material history. Now, granted, it can be difficult to see those histories, those specificities, because screen printing has a way of becoming invisible. Even among screen printing fans in the world of print studies, the medium tends to be treated as strangely insubstantial, superficial, a medium made of nothing. Part of this comes out of the kinds of surfaces that screen printing makes. Screen printing produces a particular quality of ink deposit. The sifting action of the screen mesh distributes the ink evenly across the support, while also very gently aerating it, depositing it in fluffy peaks like so many microscopic dabs of Cool Whip. This produces a uniquely velvety, saturated, unmodulated surface that tends to be devoid of associations with human creativity or agency. The painter Ad Reinhardt once referred to this as the ineffable autonomy of the silkscreen deposit, and wished he could achieve the same effect in his own paintings. No other printing method, and certainly not painting, can produce quite the same large, evenly distributed areas of rich, thick, perfectly uniform ink. When the great print curator Richard Field organized an important exhibition on screen printing in Philadelphia in 1971, he emphasized that screen printing was notable for the way it got out of the way. The screens of today, as he said, impose virtually nothing of their own character. Here he echoed another foundational print scholar, Bill Ivins, who had claimed in 1953 that the most extraordinary step in the whole history of human communication was the development of reproductive technologies whose syntactical marks, like lines, dots, etc., retreated below the threshold of normal human vision. Speaking of both the screen print and the halftone, he noted that these processes had, quote, no interfering symbolic linear syntax of their own. Now, all this is true enough. If I want to see the syntax of a halftone or a screen print, I need to get out a magnifying glass or my macro lens. But just because something retreats below the range of conscious notice does not mean that it should retreat below the range of critical study or analysis. In fact, it's rather the opposite. It's precisely when a system sinks out of sight that it becomes most powerful and is most in need of observation. Now, I want to begin that act of observation today with a look at a famous example of screen printing that gets out of the way. Josef Albers's book, The Interaction of Color. Many of you know that Albers is known for his relational theory of color. He held that color is not knowable or perceivable intrinsically, but only in relation to the quality of the other colors that surround it. The cover of this revised edition of the book shows a classic example of his work. The two brown squares that you see here are in fact exactly the same color, but they look different because of the way they interact with adjacent colors. But the paperback book in which most of us have encountered the interaction of color was not in fact the project's initial or favored format. When it was originally published in 1963, the interaction of color was a two-volume box set with color studies presented as a set of meticulously crafted screen prints. With die cuts, collages, and flaps, these pristine screen prints were the perfect vehicle for the experience of Albers's color relationships, since they permitted highly saturated, even, flawless color surfaces that did not interfere with relational perception. And although Albers produced many of his famous homage to the square compositions in oil paint, they reached their apogee as screen prints as well, with the smooth perfection of the screen print deposit removing any painterly impurities from the system. The screen prints did not seem to have their own syntax, so one could focus only on the syntax of the color itself. But as you zoom in on these screen prints, you can in fact begin to see some of that syntax that has retreated below the threshold of normal human vision. Throughout these prints, you can see the unmistakable imprint of the silkscreen mesh, which left its mark as it deposited the ink and then pulled up and away from it. So here, we might say, is the syntax of Albers's color, this mesh. But why does it matter? What is it doing? What is the work of this meshwork here? A good person to ask about this would be, in fact, Anni Albers, Bauhaus artist, theorist, and practitioner of weaving, and of course, Josef's spouse. Anni Albers wrote about weaving as an art that fuses surface values with structural values. A weaving is a soft, pliable surface associated with the world of the home and of women, with values of tactility and warmth. But it is that only because of its rigorous structure, its rectilinearity in tension, and its mathematical abstraction. In a weaving, there is no separation between idea and matter, between form and vessel, between the generation and reception of form. Silkscreen mesh is a weaving. And weavings are the perfect example of what art historian Carol Armstrong has called matrixial media, media that seem to be neutral, superficial, or merely supportive surfaces for the creation of meaning from elsewhere, but that actually generate meaning from within. We're reminded that the word matrix comes from the word for womb. Both of the images on the screen here are images of meshwork as matrixial, as actively making a world. This woven mesh, in other words, is doing things. Even if its soft and pliable structure, like women and women's work, has traditionally seemed ineffable, below the threshold of visibility, or below notice. We've actually already seen a work of art that announces the work of meshwork more broadly. In Lecture 1, Rauschenberg's hoarfrost prints, especially this one, titled Scent. This print takes silkscreen mesh out of the background and drapes it like a veil across the entire front of the image. Rauschenberg, in other words, put the mesh right up front, shaping our access to the work as a whole. This is, of course, an unorthodox use of silkscreen fabric, but it is true to the insight that these humble matrices play an active role in image formation. In his experiences in print shops, Rauschenberg had been struck more generally by the role of textiles in printing. He was interested in the many different gauzy fabrics that were used around print studios, not just silkscreen fabric, but also things like cheesecloth, which printers use to clean and prepare plates and stones between print jobs. Textiles are soft and silenced materials in the manly and metallic world of printing. Think of all those Minnesota boys again. But they do a lot of work there, and Rauschenberg brings this to our attention. So the silkscreen mesh is not neutral. It has a peculiar sort of agency. And as I'll discuss now, it also has a history that stretches beyond and before the invention of screen printing. I suggested earlier that in screen printing, images are essentially strained or sifted into being. And indeed, what we might call the primordial origins of screen printing lie not in printing, but in sifting. The fine meshes used for silk screens were originally made from bolting cloth, which was a specialized fine-gauge silk gauze that had been perfected in the 18th century for sifting flour in the production of white bread. Here's how it would work. Flour would go into a machine that actually eerily resembled a rolling press, into a cylinder lined with bolting cloth, and then that cylinder would be rotated to sift the flour through. Bolting cloth was hand-loomed by silk weavers in Switzerland for centuries and continued to be up to and through the 1960s. Now, it's important to note that screen printing mesh throughout most of the 20th century was not just inspired by bolting cloth. It was bolting cloth, literally exactly the same material. If you want to make a screen print in the mid-20th century, you buy this exact mesh from Switzerland, whose properties are ideal not only for sifting flour, but also for sifting images. Although nylon and polyester meshes had begun to replace silk by the 1960s in screen printing, silk was still considered superior. And in the logic of sifting and straining that it brought with it, it locked this idea into the entire process. Indeed, even today, screen printing remains tied to industrial sifting processes. A quick browse through the website of the CIFAR Group, currently the leading manufacturer of screen printing fabrics, demonstrates the rich connections between screen printing and an array of other processes in medicine, manufacturing, and engineering that involve filtration and fractionation. So filtration and fractionation and flour sifting may seem like pretty strange topics to import into art history. I can only assume that I am the first person to ever put this particular slide comparison together. But doing so makes perfect sense from the perspective of the history of technology or the burgeoning field of material studies. In these fields, the adoption of a new mechanical process such as screen printing in art, does not imply an obliteration of cultural and historical complexity. Instead, it implies the productive adoption of complexity from an adjacent realm of technical activity. It involves the taking up of other networks of labor, knowledge, and materials, and the merging of those networks within the fine art network. Bruno Latour, whose work has deeply inspired my own approach, emphasizes that tools and technologies are not so much de-skillers as they are shifters or skill shifters. To take up a technology is to tap into an infinitely complex network of the skills of other now absent actors. to use a technological device, quote, carries past acts into the present and permits historical innovators to disappear while also remaining present. Such detours subvert the order of time and space. In a minute, I may mobilize forces set into motion hundreds or millions of years ago in faraway places. Following Latour, I want to suggest that with every pull of the screen printer's squeegee, the ancient forces and cultures of sifting and straining are partially reactivated. These forces sit at the heart of screen printing, its technical and metaphorical center, and help us understand the relevance of the process for contemporary art. Now, for the second half of this lecture, I want to look at the work of four artists who show how this connection can become relevant for us. Ed Ruscha, Andy Warhol, Glenn Ligon, and Mona Hatoum. Let's begin with Ruscha. Ruscha, the famous Los Angeles artist, had a background in screen printing, having studied it as part of his commercial art training. In 1970, he created a portfolio of screen prints titled News, Muse, Pews, Brews, Stews, and Dews. For this series, Ruscha explicitly claimed that he was exploring the implications of screen printing as not just a process in the usual sense, but as a medium for processing. Now, although this print series is not well known today, Ruscha identifies it as one of his favorite and most important works. This portfolio of what he called organic screen prints was commissioned by the esteemed print studio Editions Alecto in London. What distinguishes it in the history of print is that rather than regular screen printing inks, Ruscha used foodstuffs like chutney, pie filling, caviar, creating screen prints that are essentially a series of strained stains. In other words, in these prints, Ruscha literally reenacts the historical connection between screen printing and straining, equating printmaking with food processing. The portfolio's colophon page gives exhaustive details about the foods that were strained through the screen for each print, their origins, and their retail sources. So News, for example, is printed with blackcurrant pie filling and red salmon roe. Muse has a background of bolognese sauce and lettering of blackcurrant pie filling over cherry pie filling over unmixed raw egg. Stews includes crushed baked beans. You can see them in the photograph here about to be dragged across the screen. Caviar, fresh strawberries, cherry pie filling, mango chutney, tomato paste, daffodils, tulips, and leaves. Pews has a background of Hershey's chocolate flavor syrup and camp coffee and chicory essence with the lettering in squid ink. Dews is just Branston pickle. And in Brews, we have axle grease over caviar. Now, the textures and tooths of the foods Ruscha selected interrupt the perfect consistency of the standard screen print deposit. When black currants and chutney chunks, or in this case caviar, got jammed in the screen, they created skips and gaps in the print. As the squeegee pressed down, the roughage in the ink blocked the screen and essentially formed a second-order stencil, creating a figure or image directly in the material of the ink. Here in Brews, the caviar created the skips in the ink and also left a fine, gritty layer behind. The effect is geological, suggesting travertine, or a stratification diagram. The print announces in its very figure the work of screening in the screen printing process. The fact that chunks and large particles become stencils here reminds us that even in more obedient screen prints made with standard inks, the stencil itself performs the role of blockage, preventing the flow of ink. The stencil is the brand, the stencil is the roughage. And thus, it dramatizes a truth of all screen printing, namely that the image is formed out of the separation of matter that goes through the screen and matter that stays behind. The distinction between refinement and coarseness is the binary system that forms the image in screen printing. Now, it's not irrelevant that this exercise in sifting and straining took place in London, where Ruscha stayed for the duration of this project. Editions Alecto, the print studio where these were made, had been establishing an international market for its prints and had also been working to attract well-known American artists to come and work there, luring them with the opportunity to spend time in swinging London. Ruscha made this print series into a site-specific project that would be about London and the experience of working there as an American. All of the ink materials were culled from scouting trips in Covent Garden groceries and the famous Harrods food halls. Most of the foods used as inks, such as blackcurrant pie filling, were common in Britain, but not the United States. And the words on the prints, of course, were words that referred to quintessentially British phenomena. As Ruscha pointed out in an interview, England is the only country that has mews. So there's this pronounced Britishness to the entire series. But what to make of this strained Britishness? What does it mean for an American to sift through British products in this way? It can't help but comment on the much longer history of British-American relations, the British Empire, and colonial political economies more generally. Consider the mercantile relations that lurked behind the American Revolution in the 18th century, in which colonials were made to send raw materials to the metropole to be refined into finished goods. We might think of Ruscha's screen prints as a kind of cheeky reversal of this historical vector. Here, Ruscha, an American, out-refines the refiners, adding another round of processing to quintessentially British Empire processed goods like Branston pickle or chutney. What's exposed in the screen printing process is actually the lumpiness of British products. The final prints are the processed refined commodity made by removing the impurities from the British goods. British processed foods become raw materials. Ruscha's prints the finished goods. His work also had pronounced geopolitical resonances in his own time. This is not just about the 18th century. Ruscha's post-war world is a world of a new American cultural and economic dominance. Britain is no longer doing the sifting, no longer doing the straining, no longer holding the global screen. Ruscha's humble screen printing activities speak to nothing less than the succession of empires. So Ruscha's portfolio performs screen printing as a dramatic binary tension between roughage and refinement. The look of the screen print is a product of the inhomogeneities in Ruscha's culinary inks. These create their own figure in the text by clogging the open areas of the weave. By interrupting, in other words, the smooth operation of the binary system, Ruscha makes its operations evident, makes visible the fact that this is an image made by some things getting through and other things getting stuck, getting held back. He reveals something about screen printing and culture that does not usually rise to the level of conscious awareness on the part of the viewer. The image is made as much by what doesn't get through as by what does. The image is formed by what is kept back, strained out, or restrained. In dramatizing the glitch or grit or clog as the agent of image formation, Ruscha was picking up on something that was also operative in Warhol's early screen prints and screen printed paintings. As I've noted, Warhol began screen printing onto canvas in 1962. Immediately over the next year or so, he established consistent iconographies and a consistent aesthetic for these works. His iconography featured especially images of movie stars taken from film stills. This is National Velvet from 1963. This is Cagney, Elvis two times. Now, thinking of this imagery in the context of straining, sifting, and refinement, it's worth noting that these were some of the first images to be associated with the new phenomenon of pop art in the US. Pop art emerged at first into the art world under the sign of vulgarity. It traumatized many tastemakers with this infusion of lowbrow hucksterism into the highbrow world of the fine arts. The critic Max Kozloff wrote in 1962 that, quote, "The truth is, the art galleries are being invaded by the pinheaded and contemptible style of gum chewers, bobby soxers, and worse, delinquents." Alan Solomon lamented in 1963 that, quote, "Instead of rejecting the deplorable and grotesque products of the modern commercial industrial world, these new artists have turned with relish and excitement to what those of us who know better regard as the wasteland of television commercials, comic strips, hot dog stands, used car lots, jukeboxes, slot machines, and supermarkets." Warhol's early screen print work deals, then, in the tension between refinement and coarseness, highlighting the byproducts, the pictorial roughage of culture, with a medium that performs the relationship between roughage and refinement in its very operation. What I want to suggest is that Warhol intuited that screen printing was the perfect medium for producing and performing this very anxiety about the adjacency of the raw and the cooked, the rough and the smooth, the coarse and the fine. There are also, in these early years, the screen prints having to do with death, known as his Death and Disaster series. Many of these featured horrific content, like car crashes littered with mangled corpses, or this one of his electric chair paintings. Actually, as Thomas Crowe has memorably established, Warhol's images of stars and celebrities already have to do with death. Jackie O at her husband's funeral, Marilyn right after her death. Liz had been gravely ill before being depicted by Warhol during these years. So essentially the content of this work is gritty. So, however, is the form. One of the hallmarks of Warhol's work is the grain, and here I would ask you to note the resonance of that term with this evening's theme of flour milling. Warhol's halftones have a coarse appearance. Warhol usually asked for the coarsest possible halftone rasters when getting his screens made. These thematize, again, the concept of the image as formed by an array of grit suspended or trapped in a grid. In many other ways in his screen print work, Warhol thematizes the screen print image as an image formed through a sieve. The streaks, gaps, and wide variations that were so striking in his early screen print work all come about by creating blockages and exploiting irregularities in the passage of ink through the screen. He would let the squeegee harden with dried ink, which forced ink more roughly through the mesh, creating black streaks. He would pour too much or too little ink into the screen, causing blotches or white streaks. And especially, he would reuse screens multiple times without cleaning them. This would cause the mesh to become clogged with dry ink, creating, like Ruscha, a second-order stencil that unmistakably announces itself as a form created through blockage. All of these screening glitches, these streaks and hardenings that interrupt the clean work of the intentional stencil, are essentially failures of proper screen printing hygiene. Now, I know I promised you in Lecture 1 that I would be spending little or no time talking about repetition in this series of lectures on print. This is one of the moments when I'm going to need to bring it in just for a moment. And that's because Warhol's images help us to see how this idea of straining relates to the practice of repetition in printing. His work makes it impossible to imagine modern reproductive media as virtual or dematerialized, because his repetitions so clearly emerge from matter and its entropic tendencies. There are no exactly repeatable pictorial statements in Warhol's work, because each repetition confronts the material remains, the clogs, the byproducts of the previous. This also makes it possible for us to see that the illusion of reproductive perfection in all printmaking is sustained by the invisible labor of hygiene and maintenance, all the cleaning and wiping of matrices between impressions, all of this making of clean slates that goes on, unnoted, in print studios. Warhol makes that maintenance work visible by showing what happens when it breaks down. So Warhol and Ruscha emphasize screen printing as a form of straining, in which the final product is shaped as much by what is held back or left out than it is by what gets through. And in the rhetoric of clogging that runs throughout their work, they also draw attention to the work of hygiene in the maintenance of these systems. The smooth operation of the binary depends upon its constant refreshment. I want to finish up with two more contemporary bodies of work that do not explicitly involve screen printing, but that activate the more general field of the stencil matrix of which the screen print is a part. Both of them powerfully explore the way that the strain of the stencil can reveal insights about binarization, restraint, visibility, gender, and maintenance. This is Glenn Ligon's painting, Prisoner of Love No. 1, made with stencils similar to those that Jasper Johns used in his early number and letter paintings. A short sentence is repeated throughout the canvas, top to bottom, without regard for line breaks. We are the ink that gives the white page a meaning. The sentence is a variation on a passage by Jean Genet about the Black Panthers from his 1986 posthumous autobiography titled Prisoner of Love. Ligon borrows similar texts throughout his work and subjects them to a similar repetition process. This one, I feel most colored when I am thrown against a sharp white background, was adapted from Zora Neale Hurston's 1928 essay, How It Feels to Be Colored Me. This, by the way, is an etching, not a painting, but I would argue that both this and the painting are fundamentally prints, even though they are classified differently by museums. Now, both of these texts speak to the relationship between binarization and sorting that we have been discussing, as well as connecting both of those things to the fundamental issue of race in America. Both of these texts argue that the very ideas of blackness and whiteness can exist only by virtue of their context in relation to each other. In particular, they suggest that whiteness needs blackness as the other through which it can be defined. The image we have of race, in other words, is sustained by an act of binary oppositional filtering. White is what you get when you strain out the black. Black is what you get when you strain out the white. Here we might remember that our story of the work of straining and sifting and stenciling began with bolting cloth, a processing matrix that was developed in order to refine flour into white bread. Ligon's work is concerned with the way the very legibility of race in American culture depends on that opposition, that series of oppositions, and how does one interrupt or destroy that? I mean legibility quite literally here, because the brilliance of his text works is that they recognize the link between racial binaries and the binaries that are inherent to printing. Ligon's paintings are made by forcing paint in the form of oil sticks through the openings of plastic stencils. Oil sticks are enormously sticky and smudgy and viscous, and every time he lifts the stencil up, there will be paint smudged on the back of the stencil and collected around the edge of the openings. As he makes each painting, Ligon repeats the text over and over without cleaning off the stencil between his returns to the canvas. As the phrases repeat, then, the sticky paint builds up on the back and the edges of the stencil and progressively obliterates the legibility of the text as it smudges more heavily with each iteration.
The way I was making the paintings was to use plastic lighter stencils and oil crayons. If you're using lighter stencils, you're trying to make something with a sharp boundary, but oil crayons want to break out of those boundaries. They're messy. They don't keep their shape. And for about 6 months, I think, I tried to figure out how to make these oil crayons make nice, neat letters. And then I realized that the fact that they didn't make nice, neat letters was actually much more interesting. Smudging them and transforming these letters into abstraction was what the paintings were about. But it took 6 months to figure that out.
Ligon here is taking two languages of print, the binary system of its articulation and its role as an engine of repetition, and essentially using them against each other. As with Warhol's paintings, repetition is what breaks down the clean legibility rather than reinforcing it. And the smudging of paint in Ligon's work echoes the themes of this straining and sifting that we've been discussing, because this process allows the byproducts of the binary stencil operation, the smudges of paint left behind, left sticking to the tool, to manifest themselves in the final work, simultaneously announcing the presence of a binary operation and breaking down its effectiveness. And speaking of byproducts, leftovers, that which is left behind, in the late 1990s, while working with James Baldwin's 1953 essay, The Stranger in the Village, Ligon began adding coal dust to the oil medium. He wanted the material he used to have, as he said, the same gravitas as the text, and he wanted to explore the particular contradictions of this dust. Coal dust is beautiful, black, and shiny, as he has put it. He chose it partially in reference, in fact, to Warhol's diamond dust paintings. But it is also literally a leftover, a waste product of coal processing. In Ligon's work, these leftovers take over the image, breaking down the ability of the stencil to generate meaning. As a commentary on the fictions and production of race, these accretions of coal dust suggest a refusal to be represented through this screen, through the strain of race relations in America. It's akin to what Edouard Glissant has called the right to opacity, in the context of race and empire, and Ligon produces it here by putting print under strain. I want to leave you with a final set of recent works, an exquisite set of rubbings on wax paper by the artist Mona Hatoum. I won't say much about them, but want them to linger with you as meditations on all of the relationships between gender, labor, matter, and strain that I've brought up in this lecture. These are not screen prints and not or not quite stencils. They're actually rubbings, but they are rubbings of strainers and colanders and other humble kitchen tools that perform, traditionally in the hands of women, the work of straining and sifting and refining and cleaning in the home. Hatoum began making them in 1996 at a residency at the Sabbath Day Lake Shaker community, and then continued them in future years while visiting her mother in Lebanon. A delicate sheet of Japanese wax paper is forced up against the inside of a strainer. It can't go through, of course, so instead it preserves the shape of that effort. The wax paper, having undergone the dimensional strain of conforming to the strainer's concavity, preserves the wrinkles and stresses of the process, the remnants of impact. The wrinkles crackle like sparks, electrical discharges gathering along the folds and crevices of what would otherwise have been invisible labor, making that labor visible, activating it like a form of feminist crackalure. The founder of the Shaker sect in America, Mother Ann Lee, said that, quote, every force evolves a form, end quote. And Hatoum's rubbings, prints that capture the action of straining just at its edge in what it leaves behind, speak to these former forces, making them visible and showing their work. Thank you. That's it for this week. Next week, the lecture will be titled Interference.